Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we sit down with filmmakers, historians, and authors, and we talk about war. And we also have narrated episodes, too, about the background to wars in history. Today's guest is Robert Draper. He's a New York Times journalist who has written several critically acclaimed books, including today's book, To Start a War, How the Bush Administration Took America into Iraq. Robert, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk to you. So, okay, first of all, I have to ask, how close of an access did you have to sources and the like for this book?
Well, I had a lot of ongoing access to members of the Bush administration that stretched back to the 1990s when I was a writer at Texas Monthly Magazine, then later at GQ, and the governor of my native state, Texas, was George W. Bush. So I knew him back then. Later, did a very lengthy biographical treatment of Bush called Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush, that was published in 2007. And for that, I had a great deal of access to the president in the Oval Office. He didn't especially appreciate that book. Wow. And so that was the last I spoke to him after that. But I continued to talk to all the senior administration officials, or at least all the ones who were sentient, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, and folks like that, all the way through to start a war.
That is incredible. And that's one of the reasons, other than the writing quality itself, which is very good, that's why your books are just across the board very highly acclaimed. Like, these are books you need to read if you want to understand what happened. That's really cool. That's rare to get that kind of access. So, okay, so bringing it back a little bit before the Iraq War, the 2003 Iraq War, the Gulf War ended in 91. So Saddam Hussein was in power back then as well. And there was this idea that people, that he wouldn't politically survive that disaster. Did that affect the way that people thought about the 2003 one when they were planning it? Like, maybe we should like not have assumptions about this guy because we don't know what's going to happen.
Sure. I think that two things happened, Emily, that at the same time that were very informing as to the decision to invade Iraq in 2003. The first was, as you mentioned, that the belief was that Saddam would be taken out by his own people, and that the U.S.-led coalition would not need to finish the job. After all, the mission was really to rout Saddam and his troops out of Kuwait, not to overthrow the regime. Yeah. But, in fact, he did survive, and that led to the second issue, was that he not only survived, but his stranglehold over the country only intensified, and his reign of terror there only continued. And so there were a lot of there was a lot of feeling of not only unfinished business, but basically that the U.S. had turned its back, particularly on the Shiite majority, and allowed Saddam to rule over them with extreme cruelty. So that certainly provides the backdrop and led a lot of people, including key members of the Bush administration, to believe that that Saddam really needed to be overthrown. But I don't think any of that would have taken place but for September 11th.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Man, it sounds a little bit like a Streisand effect. Like, hey, look over here, don't do this. And then it just like completely catastrophically backfires. Classic Streisand effect. Just a little bit more on the Gulf War here. Was that part of why George W. Bush was campaigning super strongly against nation building? Did that have anything to do with the U.S. coming out of the Gulf War?
Well, it was also it was not only coming out of the Gulf War in 1991, but that also we had just come out of the Cold War. And so there was no real appetite for nation building, certainly for wielding our military might. Bush very famously in his presidential debate against the Democrat Al Gore said that if we're humble, they'll respect us. And that was generally his posture. And so while there are some people, Emily, who have always maintained that George W. Bush was raring to take down Saddam Hussein because Hussein, after all, had attempted to assassinate Bush's father, that there's no evidence, in fact, to suggest that. I mean, no love lost, certainly, but George W. Bush wanted to be a domestic president. He was not looking to be a foreign policy president, much less to go to war. And he was hoping that smart sanctions would finally squeeze off basically any sort of power that Saddam had in his own country, and that ultimately he would be overthrown.
Oof, yeah, very different times than today. That humble thing, that's a weird thing to think about today, going like, what? Okay, let's move a little bit to the weapons of mass destruction, the big daddy in the room of this talk. That is still a very highly debated topic today with all sorts of nuance. So can you just open up real quick by telling us what the Iraq Survey Group was?
Sure. Well, the Iraq Survey Group, basically there had been, the Iraq Survey Group that you're referring to, actually, that took place well later. There were two survey groups, UNMOVIC, and before that, another group of weapons inspectors whose basic job it was at the conclusion of the first Gulf War to uncover what remained of Saddam's weapons stockpile. It was understood that he had illicit weapons, both biological and chemical. And in fact, by roughly 1990, as well as plans for nuclear mobilizing, and by about 92 or so, the inspections team had managed to get everything there was to get. But they didn't know that at the time. And Saddam, in a lot of ways, didn't want it to appear as if, okay, we've given you everything we've got. He wanted to keep kind of a cloud of mystery over it, because after all, his very powerful and geographically larger neighbors, Iran, presumably had chemical weapons as well. And the belief was that it was the only way that Iraq could stave off a possible invasion by the Iranians. So they never were forthright about what they had and what they didn't have, leading us to believe that they must be hiding something. And unfortunately, that began to sort of lead into all sorts of magical thinking. The belief that if Saddam must be hiding something, if you proceed from the view that Saddam's had weapons, still has weapons, is keeping them from us, then you view through a very dark lens almost everything that the regime does. And so every decontamination truck that was moving through one facility or another looked like something that was perhaps being used to cleanse chemical particles or something from a weapons plant, when in fact it was probably just a hydration truck and just to spray water on an agricultural facility. And everything that was bought brought into the country, any piece of metal or something, it was assumed must have some nefarious secondary purpose to it. And so this was the mindset of not only a lot of military hawks in the U.S., but also, frankly, the entire intelligence community that that was in play before September 11th began to really exacerbate any great fears, any paranoid feelings that we had about what Iraq might be capable of.
Right. And it sounds like in a post 9/11 world, like right after it happened, basically, the phrase better safe than sorry kind of takes on this monstrous size, it would seem. And Saddam had used, 15 years before that, roughly chemical weapons on his own people, the Kurds. And yes. So it's not, I can imagine it wouldn't have been crazy to think that he's capable of doing something dirty or having some sort of chemical warfare stashed away somewhere.
Sure. Well, that's right. Except the huge intuitive leap that was made by a lot of neoconservatives, some people even on the left, and members of the intelligence community, was that Saddam, having used illicit weapons on his own people, might therefore want to use weapons against a superpower like the United States. Mm-hmm. There was actually nothing in the cards, nothing whatsoever, to suggest that Saddam, even those people who believed in the intelligence community that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction that he was concealing, did not believe that he had any intention of committing the suicidal gesture of using them against the United States. And and in fact, there was a lot of evidence to suggest that though Saddam didn't exactly speak in flattering tones about the United States, that he wanted the U.S. as an ally. The U.S. had been Saddam's ally for a brief period during the time that the Shah of Iran was overthrown, and Khomeini presented a threat both to the United States as well as to the neighboring country, Iraq. They, for a variety of reasons, never became quite the alliance that Saddam had hoped. But then after 9/11, Saddam's belief was, look, you guys in the U.S. now hate Islamic extremists as much as I do. We should work together on this, because mm-hmm. they have attempted to assassinate me. They have attempted to assassinate some of my senior officials, and they present a destabilizing force in the Middle East that only strong men like myself can really go toe-to-toe with.
And that seems to be such a downplayed part of the background and everything that was going on, because a lot of people would be shocked to hear that, I think, because you really just hear about the weapons of mass destruction. You don't hear as much at all about the attempts to be an ally to us. And there are so many layers to this thing going on. And so what was it the U.S. Senate formed that intelligence committee that got together, and they were like, we're going to look into whether or not there's weapons of mass destruction. And they found that a lot of this evidence was really exaggerated. Was that accurate? Is that how that kind of went down?
Well, yes. What you're talking about is something, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, which was among the groups that did very comprehensive reports on the intelligence failures that led up to the invasion of Iraq and the failure to find weapons of mass destruction. But at the time, there was a pretty widespread consensus. It was not universal, but it was pretty widespread that Saddam had weapons. Again, the question was, what would he intend to do with those weapons? And was there ever any possibility that he would confederate with someone and give those weapons to them? There was never any evidence that any of that would take place. But September 11th distorted forever, well, not forever, but for a critical period of time, the viewpoints of American policymakers, because, as it's often been said, 9/11 was a failure of the imagination. We simply did not imagine that something like 17 or 18 or 19 terrorists could kill thousands of people and take down two skyscrapers using our own airplanes and box cutters against us as their primary weapons. And so the moment that did take place, American policymakers awakened to the recognition that since we had been caught unawares once before, there almost certainly would be a second wave of terrorist attacks. And now where would it be coming from? And this is where the unfortunate tendency took place of American policymakers not looking more into Islamic extremism, but in a lot of ways falling back on a familiar old foe, which was Iraq, and in doing so, began to ask, well, what if Iraq and Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden actually would be in cahoots? What if Saddam, who we believe has weapons, would turn them over to bin Laden so that bin Laden could basically do in an amplified way what he'd done on September 11th. This then led to all sorts of narratives and sub-narratives purporting to prove that Saddam and al-Qaeda had had these long-standing connections, which were simply untrue, but which a lot of people believed.
Okay, I wanted to ask about that. That seems kind of like its own layered onion knot, whatever you want to call it, the Saddam and al-Qaeda, where there was this whole thing where he got weapons from them, but they were also enemies, but only part of al-Qaeda hated it. What was that?
Well, it was there was a belief that Saddam and al-Qaeda had historically had much greater associations than we'd given them credit for. Just to cut to the chase on that, that wasn't true. They had, since they coexisted in the Middle East, there had been meetings now and again between upper-level people in al-Qaeda and upper-level people in Saddam's regime, but it was really sort of to take the measure of each other, not to establish some kind of, you know, evil alliance. Then, after 9/11, the imaginations of the Bush administration began to run wild, and they thought, well, as terrible as September 11th was and the loss of 3,000 lives, it could have been so much worse. Imagine if they had not just used, you know, some airplanes to run into buildings, but imagine if they had used chemical warfare or, God forbid, biological weapons. And, and if they were to do that, where would they get them from? Well, we believe that Saddam Hussein has always possessed them. And we also believe that Saddam Hussein, who, after September 11th, the day after, was really the only foreign leader in the world to say, basically, America had it coming to them. You know, this is the rotten fruit of America's awful policies and hostile view of Islam. And so it sounds like Saddam doesn't like us particularly. We've always believed Saddam has these weapons. What if he were to turn them over to al-Qaeda, who we believe, these are certain people in the Bush administration, actually have closer associations. So there's a lot of deductive leaps in all of this thinking, and fine to have some voice around a policy-making table in the National Security Council arguing about this, but this actually began by early 2002 to be the predominant view in the Bush administration. And by early 2002, it became increasingly clear that the Bush administration was on a track to go to war. And with a few procedural niceties along the way, like having weapons inspectors go in and all that, but at no point really an exhaustive view of what would the second and third order consequences be if we were to invade. Why is it really necessary to invade in terms of an actual threat to the United States? And maybe we should really revisit all of our intelligence to determine whether or not Saddam really does have these weapons of mass destruction that we've believed for years without any hard proof that he has.
Right. So it seems like in a very heightened emotion era, where paranoia is just growing and growing and growing, there's like this maybe shadow guy, and it just kind of went wild from there. Lots of leaps of deduction, like you were saying.
Well, yes, and it stems from a kind of prejudice, a basic bias that Saddam Hussein is an evildoer. In fact, you know, in 1998, during the Clinton administration, the Iraqi Liberation Act was passed in Congress, and it didn't have a whole lot of muscle to it, but it was a congressional resolution that established that Saddam was an enemy of America. We didn't pass the same kind of legislation about North Korea or about Iran. So so there was precedent already for viewing Iraq in the darkest of terms. Then 9/11 happens, and there began to be this frenzy intensified by the anthrax scare that took place in Washington and elsewhere, and the momentary belief that perhaps the anthrax had come from Iraq, since the regime at one point did produce anthrax. It very quickly became clear that this anthrax was an altogether different strain than the kind that Iraq had produced. But by that point, Iraq was once again seeping into the national narrative, and it was becoming more and more seeming like an inevitability, conjoined with what had taken place in 9/11, when in fact those were two very distinct, you know, different things: how to regard Saddam Hussein versus how to react to a terrorist attack by Al-Qaeda. And the twinning of those two was a really unfortunate occurrence, a calamitous one, but one for which the Bush administration had a lot of help. They had help in the media. They had help on Capitol Hill. And so to the extent that there would have and should have been checks on these crazy deductive leaps, the institutions that were set up to best operate as a kind of check folded.
I think we'll be studying this for a long time about how that happened, and I hope we learned something from that. Not holding my breath, but I hope we learned something from that. Okay, I know we don't have very much time left, so I just have a couple more questions here. Why was the Department of State at odds with the CIA and the Department of Defense during the post-war planning phase of the Iraq War?
Well, I mean, there had been, for the most part, the intelligence community, you know, the CIA and the Department of State had been pretty much in lockstep. The real problems was with the Defense Department and the Department of State. The State Department had long been of the view that, look, if we're going to go in to a and remove a tyrannical regime, then it's not like democracy is just going to spring up overnight. It's going to be a painstaking process. It will take years and years. The Defense Department's view, led by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, was, no, we're actually going to, first of all, it's not our job to nation build. We don't do windows, as they say. We are instead, as Rumsfeld said, going to take our hands off the bicycle seat and let the Iraqis pedal off and do it all themselves. A very condescending view of the Iraqis. But Rumsfeld's view was to get in and get out, and whatever messiness took place, let the Iraqis own it, but they should be thanking us for removing a tyrant from their soil.
Right.
The Department of State had a much more nuanced view, and as it turned out, a great deal more realistic, because their view was, look, if you take out this powerful force, you obviously create a power vacuum. Who will fill that vacuum? Well, true. We shouldn't be the ones to say. We shouldn't be installing a leader. But when we don't install a leader and we leave it up to the Iraqis, and the Iraqis themselves have no experience with a democratic government, then in all likelihood, other hostile actors will come in. And in the form of Sunni extremists, for example, leading ultimately to the formation of ISIS. And so there were all of these militia groups and other hostile forces that made it not only a quagmire for our troops there, and a very dangerous one at that, but a very, very unstable political environment that made it all but impossible to stand up a democratic form of government.
Okay. And then also, you got to think that part of that debate, that discussion, was what happened in Iran, and that didn't go very well. And, you know, we had a kind of a track record of poking around at these things, and they're chaotic and they typically don't go very well. So I can imagine that those things were part of the debate, like, no, that's a bad idea. We shouldn't be super involved, but we should be a little involved, but not too involved, and around and around and around.
Well, when it came to Iran, I mean, they didn't have a democratic regime. They had a Shah who was an autocrat. And he was our autocrat. He was an ally of ours. And so we certainly did all that we could to prop him up. But it incurred resentment from the Muslims who lived there in Iran, that this was an autocratic regime that was secular and supported by the West. And so so we actually didn't do any nation building when it came to Iran.
Okay, right.
But it's Russia had tried for years in Afghanistan, and then in the wake of 9/11, when we took down the Taliban, our efforts to support Hamid Karzai were protracted and messy, and ultimately didn't bear fruit. And now the Taliban is in charge of Afghanistan again. So, these are always messy endeavors, mm-hmm. Part of what made Saddam stay in power for as long as he did was that he was a politician, and he understood, as many politicians do, how to demagogue, how to curry favor with people on the street. And one way he would do it would be to trash talk the Americans, and that was a very popular thing for the Arab street. And then we realized that, well, you know, this is sometimes when you leave democracy up to the voters, you don't necessarily get the results that you want.
Yeah, and how much meddling had we been doing in South America by this point, trying to prop up democracy? And it
sure
did
well,
not
in
go
America
well.
And in Africa, and mm-hmm. and that's right. So, but more often than not, it's been the U.S. propping up a strong man who would be an ally to ours and a stabilizing force in that area and keep down anti-American sentiment. But. These are always fraught propositions,
and yes,
the Iraq War, you know, the catastrophic decision to invade a country that had not attacked us or posed any threat to us is one that we're still paying for. It has informed a generation of voters. We wouldn't have Trump without this. We wouldn't have had Obama without it, and in ways that are recognizable and also complicated, this mistake will live with us for decades and decades to come,
if not centuries. Like, it's just a ripple effect.
Sure.
Okay, so the last question I have is, since the Iraq War ended, has Bush ever said that if he could go back and do something different, he would do something differently?
No and yes. I mean, what Bush has done is concede that the war was a messy war, that it took longer than he thought, that the reconstruction efforts and standing up the new democratic regime was far more complicated than he had. But Bush has never once said it was a mistake. And in fact, none of his senior officials have said that. The one who came the closest was Colin Powell, now deceased, but even Secretary of State Powell did not explicitly say it was wrong to do it. And I, Colin Powell, should have stood up against it. So it's the hate that dare not speak its name, I guess you could say, you know, in the Bush administration. And President Bush has been very sanguine in saying, look, time will tell, and I'm comfortable with how history will view me. Well, as it appears now, and of course things could change, but it appears now that Bush will be viewed the way Hoover will be viewed, by a single calamitous policymaking, you know, mistake that took place on his watch, and there were many, many other laudatory and interesting things that the Bush administration did. There is a whole presidential library that's devoted to all those things, just like there is a Hoover library in Iowa.
Right.
But the only wings that people pay attention to are the ones related to the Depression or the ones that relate to the Iraq War.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, okay. Thank you so much for coming on the show and answering all these questions. Do you have any books coming up that you're working on?
Not just now. There's a project that I'm just beginning, but I have not even negotiated the terms with my publisher yet.
So,
a little bit premature.
Okay. All right. Maybe in the future we can talk about that. Okay. Robert Draper, author of To Start a War, How the Bush Administration Took America into Iraq. You can find it on Amazon or anywhere else that you buy books. Thank you again so much.
Sure thing.
All right. Bye.
Take care.